career coach, Nina Delavecchia, and much more. You will also receive a WBAI tote bag, which you can use to carry around some on-air giveaways. For more information, go to give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Programming note, Max Politics, which is usually on at this time, will return next Wednesday at 5 p.m. In the meantime, take a listen to the show that's about to air.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice.
Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize for another world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Now, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music, with its author, one of the great historians of our times, Gerald Horn. And during our exploration with Gerald Horn, we'll thread into the discourse the sounds of Miles Davis and the making of one of the greatest jazz albums ever, Kind of Blue. And then we'll chase train, yes, John Coltrane, that is, and the making of his tune, Alabama, which immortalizes the loss of four little girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham in 1963 by members of the Ku Klux Klan. Gerald Horn, take us on a journey through your work, Jazz and Justice, and tell us what it means for descendants of enslaved people to create a music embraced by the world and still be treated as second-class citizens, exploited, dehumanized, and subject to premature death as you follow the money, the managers, the musicians, and the bodies, and teach how racial capitalism shaped black classical music. I'm really interested in starting our discussion with the quote from Julian Priester, the trombonist, which says, once jazz moved from creative music to product, jazz lost its identity. As soon as capitalism enters the equation, there's no caring about the artistic properties that jazz as a music makes available. Capitalism tends to bring out the negative side of the human mind. This is unique because it's Jazz and Justice, Racism, and the Political Economy of the Music. Gerald, begin by telling us what inspired your writing of Jazz and Justice.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I guess what drove me would include a number of factors. Number one, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which has been a headquarters for music of all kinds. You know that Miles Davis was born and raised in that metropolitan area across the Mississippi River in mostly East St. Louis. And my family is a musical family. My younger brother is a well-known jazz guitarist who actually resides in New York, played with Elvin Jones, the former drummer with Coltrane, played with Chico Hamilton, and also played in Aretha Franklin's last band before she passed away. And so I grew up listening to all kinds of music. And then on our block in North St. Louis was the Bowie family. That is to say, the patriarch of the family and his sons, which included Joseph Bowie, a trombonist of some note, who played in bands with my younger brother from the time they were like 11 or 12. And then, of course, the late, great Lester Bowie of the Art Ensemble of Chicago fame, and Byron Bowie, who was my contemporary. And then, in terms of St. Louis as well, there was this blues AM station, KATZ. So I grew up listening to the blues all the time. And as you know, the blues, in some ways, forms the backbone of this music we call jazz, which, by the way, is a music based upon mastery of different instruments, including but not limited to piano, drums, bass, horns, guitar, etc. And oftentimes involves improvisation at a high level of quality. And I should also say that if you grew up in Cincinnati, for example, across the river in Kentucky, you had a sort of wide open cities and towns. That's where the nightlife was. And the same thing was in St. Louis, right across the Mississippi River is in St. Louis. And so, believe it or not, as a teenager, a person like myself could cross the Mississippi River and listen to music up until 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning. You might recall that that's where Ike and Tina Turner first hit it big, on the east side, or East Boogie, as they call it in St. Louis. And so that's the sort of background that helped to shape my musical tastes and my interest in doing this book. And I should also say that as a historian and as an activist, I've had an abiding interest in popular culture. I did a book on boxing. I did two books on Hollywood. So this book, in many ways, it's just a logical extension of that interest.
I've always seen the development or the evolution of Black classical music. It's the soul, it's the essence of a particular form of expression of people of African ancestry. And it's been in that soul through the diaspora and through the Middle Passage. So many of the instruments came from Africa, including what we don't think of today or understand, which is used in bluegrass and so many other forms, and that is instruments like the banjo. What does this music mean in terms of the kind of the essence of expression, again, a particular kind of expression? It's a lyrical expression. It's an improvisational expression. But what is jazz for the people of African ancestry?
I probably should begin the way I begin in the book, or at least the first chapter, talking about the origins of this music, which is a contested story. Now, my brothers and sisters from New Orleans would not agree that it's contested. They think that the issue is settled, that this music had its origins in New Orleans, Louisiana, that it's rooted in the fact that, point one, that as early as 1862, the Lincoln government during the U.S. Civil War had seized New Orleans, which was a deadly blow to the pretensions of the so-called Confederate States of America, which is trying to secede from the United States in order to enslave Africans forevermore. With the ending of the Civil War, the U.S. government, as you probably know, even to this very day, the Pentagon probably spends more on bands and music than as much as any force on planet Earth. That bloated, overly inflated Pentagon budget, which is creeping towards $1 trillion a year of our tax money. And so they leave instruments behind, which are then picked up by the newly freed, formerly enslaved Africans. This takes place in the context of another intriguing point. New Orleans had not only a strong musical culture, particularly opera, but on top of that, you have to realize that before Plessy versus Ferguson, as a lawyer, you're familiar with that case in the 1890s, where Homer Plessy, who we would describe as a light-skinned Negro, wants to evade sitting in a Jim Crow car with other Negroes. And in many ways, this is the last gasp of the French and Spanish settler colonialism, which differs from Anglo settler colonialism, because from the founding of New Orleans circa 1718 up through Plessy in the 1890s, you had this group, which we would call light-skinned Negroes, but basically they were sort of an in-between group between the black population and the so-called white population. And they had certain privileges that the darker skin did not have. And many of them were educated in France. Many of them only spoke French, for example. As a matter of fact, some of the recent scholarship suggests that part of their being folded into this larger black community, where they are today, I should say, involved becoming monolingual in English, like most of their fellow black Americans. And so when you have a musician like Jelly Roll Martin, who plays a role in my book, who says, Jelly Roll Martin says, I invented jazz. Now, that's oftentimes seen as hyperbole, and I guess you could say it, that it is. But if you dig a little deeper, you can interpret what he's saying is that in order to understand the origins of this music, you not only have to understand point number one concerning what I just said about the newly enslaved grabbing up the instruments that the military bands are leaving behind, but you have to understand this, what we would call the light-skinned Negro population and their cultural traditions, which then, of course, feeds into a musician like Jelly Roll Martin, who may not have invented jazz, but certainly was a key pioneer. So also when you talk about this New Orleans story, you talk about Storyville, which is this red light district, so-called, but you said euphemism, where the owners of these bordellos are hiring black musicians, or what we would call black musicians. And also another footnote in terms of the unique culture of New Orleans is that one of the most significant lynchings in the history of the United States takes place in New Orleans in the 1890s as this music is taking off. But it involves Sicilians. And it's quite a lesson because what happens is outrageous the Italian government. Apparently, they're in the process of sending a flotilla across the ocean to New Orleans. And it illustrates the point that one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why the indigenous population, the Native American population, the black population have been the recipient of so many atrocities is that when we were lynched, there was no nation like Italy intervening or threatening to intervene, which, of course, then gives rise to the Pan-Africanist idea, gives rise to Garveyism, which arises approximately a little more than a century ago. So in any event, New Orleans, according to this thesis, is the heart of where, it's the crucible where this music was created. And people point to Congo Square in New Orleans, because that's where oftentimes the drumming would take place. Keep in mind that in other slave societies, drumming was forbidden. Just like in other slave societies, it was forbidden for the enslaved to have horns because it would be seen as a way to rally. And there's a long-term horn tradition in many African societies. And I would be remiss in talking about the origins of this music. And I mentioned Jelly Roll Martin. Of course, the other people would point to Louis Armstrong, who, of course, his roots are in New Orleans. The airport in New Orleans is named after Louis Armstrong, believe it or not. And he is the vocalist and trumpet player. Many people would argue that some of the traditions that he helped to create have in the music have not been surpassed to this day. But what happens around the time of World War One is that Stuartville is shut down, and then you have this is the traditional story at least, and then you have a sort of diaspora from New Orleans, like Armstrong moves north to Chicago, etc. Now that's one theory. Then there's a kind of what I call a candelabra theory, which is that the music arises simultaneously in many different sites, including New Orleans. You'll probably get angry emails from your New Orleans listeners, so they don't like to hear this. But if you look at Memphis, for example, a city also amongst the Mississippi River, or St. Louis, for example, or even, there's some evidence to suggest a kind of jazz erupting in the San Francisco Bay Area, which, of course, did not have a substantial Negro population before 1942. And then, of course, people point to other nodes for this music, which would include Cuba. And, of course, there's a lot of intercourse before 1959 between Cuba and New Orleans, that is to say, before the Cuban Revolution. And there are many noteworthy Cuban musicians. And then, as we know, jazz is an international phenomenon as well. I mean, it's not only that the grandson of Booker T. Washington was a jazz clarinetist who then migrates and expatriates to Brazil. You have Ethiopian jazz, you have Jamaican jazz. Your listeners are probably familiar with the Jamaican pianist Monty Alexander. So I think part of the issue with regard to New Orleans, with all due respect, is that what happens is that the archivist and librarian at Tulane University in New Orleans began doing oral histories of musicians, some of whom were born in the 1880s or even before. And they began doing these oral histories early on. Some of them you can find online. And I think that tips the scales, because if you're looking for unfortunately, the librarians and archivists at University of Memphis did not do this kind of work. And so there's no motherlode of oral histories of black Memphis musicians to the extent that there is of black New Orleans musicians or black St. Louis musicians, for example. And so I think that tips the scales and overdetermines this idea of New Orleans being the source, the code, if you will, for this music.
Let's talk about the history of jazz, both the evolving music and the style the music takes, which coincides with various forms of racial exploitation and discrimination, which is experienced continuously and currently by artists of African ancestry. What does that say about the music, and where does capitalism come into play as it affects both the production of the music, the airing of the music, and what the hell happened with the artists who were involved in this profound and magnificent improvisational form of expression?
Long footnote about the intersection of Native Americans and Black Americans, because it's not just Jimi Hendrix, the well-known guitarist, who was African and indigenous ancestry. There were a number of black musicians who were apparently of the same ancestry. I say this apparently because just like I talked a moment or two ago about this in-between group of what we would call light-skinned Negroes who only began being folded into the black community post-Plessy versus Ferguson in the 1890s. In the bad old days, or the worst old days, I should say, of Jim Crow, many black people would claim Native American ancestry because they were embarrassed to claim African ancestry. So you have to take that into account. But having said that, I do think in that footnote there's a lot for future scholars to work with in terms of trying to track down the bicultural nature of this music, at least of some of these musicians, I should say. Now, with regard to capitalism, let me first jump ahead by saying that when you gave that quote from Julian Priester, what I was thinking of was the distinction between various kinds of capitalism, because I think what he said was right on with regard to this rapacious U.S. capitalism suffused with slavery. However, if you look at certain other capitalist countries, particularly capitalist countries which have stronger social democratic, socialist, and communist traditions, you'll find that that's one of the reasons why you've had such expatriation of so many black musicians to Europe. It's because oftentimes they find that it's easier to live because there are government subsidies, for example. That's one of the reasons why Dexter Gordon, the lanky saxophonist from Los Angeles, spent so much time in Denmark, for example. Why the man we knew as Kenny Clark, the drummer, spent so much time in France. I believe that Art Farmer, a horn man, spent time in Vienna. So it's this U.S. capitalism that Mr. Priester, I think, was on the money with regard to, which is not to downplay the kind of exploitation that black American musicians could face in Europe, because there's been a lot of recent scholarship suggesting that there were certain problems that they encountered there. But I think that it would be a mistake to assume that every capitalist country is like the United States of America. I don't think that would be an accurate assessment. Now, with regard to exploitation, of course, it goes back to the Bordellos, the rise of forms of this music in Kansas City, particularly in the 1920s and in the 1930s, when Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, were both wide-open towns, not unlike East St. Louis or Covington, Kentucky. And this is a time when you have this political machine there that then gives rise to the U.S. president, Harry S. Truman, who becomes president after 1945 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt passes away. And the clubs are basically dominated by organized crime. So it's organized crime that basically runs the clubs. And organized crime, they're not necessarily equal opportunity employers. They're not necessarily social democratic employers. But what's interesting, and this is a typical U.S. phenomenon about what happens simultaneously across the state in St. Louis, when organized crime wants to hire black musicians for the clubs and the Ku Klux Klan wants them to be excluded. And so there's a literal showdown between the Klan and the mob, organized crime. And perhaps not surprisingly, organized crime wipes the floor with the mob, and then black musicians win the dubious distinction of being able to be exploited in clubs by the mob as opposed to being excluded from clubs altogether. Those are the sort of mutually distasteful options that we're oftentimes left with.
You're listening to an Equal Rights and Justice special with Gerald Horn, based on his book Jazz and Justice, where we now thread into our discussion the making of one of the greatest jazz albums of all times with a Miles Davis quintet from the film Miles Davis. Birth of the Cool.
A new way of approaching improvisation.
Start again, please. Here we go.
Well,
62-291. Number two, take
wait
one.
Wait 1 minute.
I was probably the first one there because I had to set up the drum. So I had my drums, set them up, and waited till everybody else filed in. He just came in with little notes that he had. He didn't even have sheet music for that. And the only thing he told me was, like, just swing, you know? He says, just swing.
I didn't write out the music for Kind of Blue. But brought in sketches because I wanted a lot of spontaneity in the playing. I knew that if you've got some great musicians, they will deal with the situation and play beyond what is there and above where they think they can.
The first part of So What? Do boom bang. Do boom boom. Do do dee do do da 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 da. Do dee do 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 do. Then Paul go into the bass thing, bo do bo do bo do bo do.
Boom 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 boom. Man, that was the first thing I ever heard from Miles. Grab the record out of my father's record collection, put it on. First thing that catches your ear is Paul Chambers playing that bass line.
Even question the sacred text that we have, right? Like, you know, I mean, why is the Bible the Bible? It's the Bible, you know? I mean, why is Kind of Blue Kind of Blue? It's kind of blue. Like, it just is, and it changed the sound of jazz.
The cymbal crash at the start of So What, I thought I had overdone it. It sounded louder than it should have been to me.
Seems to ring forever, but it brings you right into the tune. It's like you've hit the highway, and the rest of the tune just takes off.
On Kind of Blue, what he asked them to do was to think deeper about what kind of sound can you create. He said, I have these few ideas. Let's go. And this is something that Miles does for the rest of his life.
Blue doesn't really give away his passion so easily. But at the same time, once those musicians open up, they show you how inventive and ingenious they can be and how incendiary.
Signified a different way of thinking about your music and a different way of playing the music and approaching the music. And for Coltrane, that was the door he needed to find his own identity.
Few people hear the potential in the young John Coltrane, but Miles brought him along and provided Coltrane space to become the artist who we would later love and revere.
People that don't even like jazz like that album. Every decade or something, there's just new people talking about kind of blue. That's what started me to listen to jazz music.
You can listen hundreds of times. It always has something new to say. And that, for me, is a definition of a masterpiece.
I don't think Miles knew that that was going to be a record that would sell more records than any record in the history of jazz music.
This is Equal Rights and Justice, a fund drive special. And to support this Truth and Justice radio station, if you call 212-209-2950, that's 212-209-2950, for a $100 pledge for Jazz and Justice, you'll receive a thank you gift, the complete 80-minute talk by Gerald Horn on jazz and justice, racism, and the political economy of the music. One of the greatest historians of our times, Gerald Horn, and the two exceptional films, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, featuring never-before-seen archival footage, studio outtakes, and rare photos. Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, tells the story of a truly singular talent and unpacks the music and the myth of the man behind the horn. And you'll receive Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary, an exploration of the global power and impact of the music of John Coltrane, where the passions, experiences, and forces that shaped his life and revolutionary sounds are revealed. Call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and ask for your Jazz and Justice gift with your pledge of $100. And now we resume our discussion with Gerald Horn on Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music.
Chicago, due northeast of St. Louis, also becomes a headquarters for this music. And there, organized crime figures also reign supreme in terms of the clubs. And then, of course, there's the further dilemma that these musicians face when they go on the road. Because oftentimes when they go on the road, there's always a problem in terms of finding a place to eat, finding a place to go to the bathroom, finding a lodging, for example. Then there's the further issue that sometimes they'll play at sites where there's Jim Crow or segregation. There's a rope down the middle of the hall where they're playing, where black people are on one side and those defined as white on the other side. And then some of these musicians being, you know, they have a job as a musician. Sometimes they have extra money that then draws the ire of many racists who did not like to see these young black men with dollars in their pockets and instruments, saxophones, guitars, etc., particularly suspecting that this may allow them to be attracted to certain Euro-American women, which then can lead to all kinds of mayhem and mutilation, which is not unknown during that time. And so it's a very difficult road, to put it mildly, for these musicians, which then leads to disparate paths. One path is expatriation. I mentioned Dexter Gordon and Kenny Clarke, et cetera, but it's a mass phenomenon because these musicians, they have fungible skills. And so by talking about these black musicians, including Buck Clayton in Shanghai, China. Shanghai is a sort of a wide open town at that time. Wide open meaning that you have colonialism of a special type in China, whereas in India, for example, it's British India, whereas Shanghai is divided between different powers, including a rising Japan. And so what happens is you see a migration of black musicians to China. You see a migration of black musicians to the Philippines. In fact, some of the best cover bands, that is to say bands that can duplicate the sound of jazz musicians, rock musicians, whatever kind of musicians, to this very day are based in the Philippines. You have a jazz diaspora, as noted, to Brazil, to Cuba, to Europe, I mean, all over the world, because these mostly black musicians, they're trying to escape the grim reaper of Jim Crow. And then another path domestically is organized. That is to say, organizing musicians' unions. And there hangs a tale, because there are these Jim Crow locals, as they're called, colored musicians locals. And then there are the, I guess you could say, non-colored musicians locals. But what happens there is that oftentimes the club owners are more disposed to hiring what I call the non-colored musicians for various reasons, even though they might not be as talented. And then with the rise of the anti-Jim Crow movement, particularly pursuant to the strategies pursued by the NAACP, you have a forced liquidation of the colored musicians' locals, which then means that the black musicians are folded into the larger so-called white locals, which means they're subjected, which means, number one, oftentimes their records are destroyed and their historical memory is punctured with their records being destroyed. But also, then they become subject to oftentimes what could be easily termed the tyranny of these white musicians who still have an in with club owners. But before that happens, I should also mention the role of New York City, because, as I'm sure you know, New York was a headquarters for this music, and in some ways, New York was attracting musicians from all over the country, all over the world, and in fact, denuding places like New Orleans and St. Louis of some of their most talented musicians, because oftentimes there were more opportunities in New York. But what happens there is that for the longest time, this music was associated not only with improvisation, but with dancing. But when it begins to flower in New York, there are those who object to interracial coupling of men and women on the dance floor, particularly black men and Euro-American women. And that leads to certain crackdowns on clubs that allow for such. And then you have this transition. I think that creates favorable conditions, shall we say, for the music then becoming much more of a listening music, much more so than a danceable music.
When you talked about listenable music, one of the deprivations which you point out, etc., which was particularly problematic, and yet the music winds up flourishing, that African-American jazz musicians are denied exposure to radio airplay and jukebox access, and they're barred from clubs entirely in many instances, some of which you mentioned, or they're permitted to perform only in segregated conditions. In addition to this, which very often continued having musicians who could not work full-time, and yet it's amazing how they persevered and developed their skills. so that you have folks like Cecil Taylor, right, who is a restaurant worker, and Roy Haynes, who's a whiskey salesman, the great drummer, and the trombonist J.J. Johnson, who works in the post office, and saxophonist Big Mick Nicholas, who works in the post office, and Jimmy Owens, etc., the trumpeter, who's a hospital worker. So the particular deprivations and role of racism as it played out in the ability to be full-time musicians and the ability to have the music heard in the widest array of areas, it's so critical to understand what's happened with jazz today, which I think these are enormously productive and important issues.
Well, I should also add to that litany that you just cited, McCoy Tyner, the late great pianist working as a cab driver. In terms of the difficulties, how Irving Mills, who was the so-called manager of Duke Ellington, the great conductor, pianist, composer with roots in Washington, D.C., how he maneuvers mischievously to place his name, Irving Mills' name, on certain Ellington compositions, which means that today, 2021, there are certain tunes created by Ellington, but the Ellington estate would have difficulty in accruing the revenues and the royalties from those compositions, but the estate of Irving Mills would, which shows you the dead hand of white supremacy and Jim Crow, and that old quotation about how the past is not past. It's still operating. You know, it's like the monster in the movie. You drive a stake through its heart, but somehow it arises from the casket. Then there's the related problem when you have these musicians like the late, great drummer activist Max Roach, whose roots in the Caribbean, the Great Dismal Swamp, the North Carolina and Virginia border, which was the home of many maroon communities that would say black people would escape from the bonds of slavery and establish their own communities. And then, of course, Brooklyn, New York. He and Mingus, who you mentioned with regard to Haitian fight song, they try to start a record company to try to do an end run around the labels, because a good deal of this book, as you know, deals with how these record labels, including Atlantic Records, which I believe is still with us, which was started by Ahmet Ertegun, a Turkish national whose father was posted to Washington, D.C. as a diplomat, and then because the Turkish embassy was Turkish soil, he began organizing concerts at the Turkish embassy to circumvent the Jim Crow laws, and from there migrated into starting this record company and becomes fabulously wealthy in the process by dint of exploitation of musicians. And part of this is, once again, in terms of cinematic reference, there's an Ahmet Ertegun character in the movie Ray, with Jamie Foxx's Oscar-winning performance. But in any case, Max Roach and Mingus, they try to start this company, but you know, there's a reason why the system is called monopoly capitalism. Monopoly means that a lot of the bases are occupied and that it's difficult to break into that system. Not to mention the fact that if you do try to break into that system, there's always the lurking menace of organized crime, which is not above using roughhouse tactics in order to discourage you and your business. And then, of course, there's the related problem of the record labels and the club owners, particularly up to 1945, one could say consciously and intentionally trying to push drugs, hard drugs, as they're called, onto these musicians to make them more pliable, shall we say, and more susceptible to being exploited. And you can cite chapter and verse with regard to that. And then there's the related issue. When I talk about John Coltrane, the late great saxophonist, with roots in both North Carolina and in Philadelphia. And I should also say that Thelonious Monk, who you reference, also has roots in North Carolina in addition to New York. Some of John Coltrane's contemporaries and successors have suggested that he sometimes would practice 16 hours a day. Now, if you're practicing your craft 16 hours a day, that does not leave much time to attend to the business aspects of your career. And it makes you more susceptible to relying upon those who are, quote, managing, unquote, your career. And if they're like Irving Mills, you're basically putting your future and your present in the hands of a barracuda. So these are some of the multiple problems that these musicians have encountered over the decades.
I just want you to flesh out a bit more when we're going back to the hook that the clubs played and organized crime. What's the correlation between that hook that they grabbed onto with these remarkable musicians and the reality of racism and how that almost became a subset of capital to control and use these musicians? I mean, what caused really organized crime to latch onto the jazz musician? We understand why they may have needed it to have venues to play in and so on, but it would seem quite peculiar that organized crime families themselves would gravitate to that. And then also you raise another point, which is that drugs become currency. So talk more about that phenomena, too, in the remarkable story that you give us about the evolution and development of jazz and justice.
First of all, I'm sure you're familiar with the era known as Prohibition, which takes place approximately 100 years ago when there is an attempt systematically to outlaw alcohol. As a matter of fact, one of the most significant women's organizations historically in this country was the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU, which campaigned against alcohol because part of the theory of the case was that the husbands, they get their paycheck, they go to the bar, they fritter it away by drinking, then they come home and they're drunk, and that leads to all manner of abuse, etc. And so when that movement reaches a sort of success with the banning of alcohol, then, of course, that leads, I'm sure you've seen the movies, that drives alcohol underground or drives it into speakeasies, drives it into clubs, and then organized crime, including certain families that become respectable. I'm thinking of the Bronfman family, B-R-O-N-F-M-A-N. Which to this very day is one of the more affluent families in the United States of America, and at one time controlled not only liquor like Seagram's and other well-known brands, but also had a major stake in DuPont, a chemical corporation based in Delaware, major stake in Hollywood Studios, major stake in the music business as well, because what happens is that with the speakeasies and the clubs, just like the bordellos, you're trying to attract people to the club so that they could buy this liquor. Just like in Las Vegas, where gambling is at center stage, you oftentimes have singers and musicians, which then attracts people to the casinos so that the people can fritter their money away in the slot machines and at the roulette table. And so therein you begin to see how organized crime gravitates towards clubs. But also you should know that organized crime oftentimes gravitates towards cash businesses and oftentimes especially then, perhaps even today, these clubs, they throw off a lot of cash. You need cash to enter the club. You need cash to buy drinks. And then when you have cash business, this allows for money laundering. That is to say that if you want to make a deposit in a bank and you have a licit business and an illicit business, you can mix the proceeds from both together and make the sub-$10,000 deposit, which presumably will not alert the authorities that you're dealing in large amounts of cash. And so you'll find that organized crime oftentimes is gravitating towards cash businesses. That would include restaurants, for example, where you oftentimes find them as well. So that helps to shed light upon their relationship to the clubs. And then the same thing holds true to a certain extent with so-called illicit drugs, so-called hard drugs, because they also become a site where you can purchase these drugs. And then that gets into the political aspects, the political economy, if you like.
You're listening to an Equal Rights and Justice fundraising special with Gerald Horn based on his book, Jazz and Justice. We now thread into our discussion Chasing Train, John Coltrane, that is, and the making of his tune Alabama, which immortalizes the loss of four little girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham in 1963 by members of the Ku Klux Klan. John Coltrane, whose passions, experiences, and forces shape a revolutionary life and revolutionary sound.
Birmingham is a symbol of hardcore resistance to integration. It is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States, and the injustices inflicted upon Negroes are the notorious realities.
Growing up in the South, of course, I know he wanted things to be better. But he didn't talk about it. I think he put that in his music.
Took politics in his music. It was only a few months after that horrible bombing of a church, and he wrote a piece called Alabama.
And it shows the creativity and depth of Coltrane, a beautiful elegy screaming with pain, undergirded by love. I mean, it was just, it's a masterful piece, really.
Children, unoffending, innocent, and beautiful, were the victims of one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity.
Coltrane himself told McCoy Tyner, his piano player, that he developed the melody out of a speech that Martin Luther King gave.
And today, as I stand over the remains of these beautiful, darling girls, I paraphrase the words of Shakespeare. Good night, sweet princesses. Good night, those who symbolize a new day. And may the flight of angels take thee to thy eternal rest.
Martin Luther King Jr., John Coltrane go hand in hand. Hand in hand. Why? Because they're love wars. They represent the best, not just of black people, not just for America. They represent the best of the human spirit.
That song has a soul that lets you know that there was a lot of pain going on there, but it's something that's inspirational about that song. When you hear Alabama, you feel all that struggle. From those times, the times of the civil rights days, but you also feel the progress.
John Coltrane was ahead of his time. I don't think that his music is a thermometer, it's a thermostat. See, a thermometer just reflects the climate. A thermostat shapes the climate. So when you hear Alabama, it's not just his deep love of the precious four girls who were killed by cowardly white supremacists in 16th Street Baptist Church. It's not just a refiguration musically of certain speech patterns of Martin Luther King Jr. He's looking at black people all the way down the row. He's already telling us you're going to need courage, vision, and most importantly, love at the center of it.
As black people, we've been through a lot in this country, and we stay hopeful. And that's what I feel in Alabama is the pain we went through, but the hope that we have.
Been listening to an Equal Rights and Justice fundraising special. And to support this Truth and Justice radio station, if you call 212-209-2950, that's 212-209-2950, for a $100 pledge for Jazz and Justice, you'll receive a thank you gift, the complete 80-minute talk on jazz and justice, racism, and the political economy of the music by one of the greatest historians of our time, Gerald Horn, and the two exceptional films, Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary, an exploration of the global power and impact of the music of John Coltrane, with passions, experiences, and forces that shaped his life and revolutionary sounds are revealed. And Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, featuring never-before-seen archival footage, studio outtakes, and rare photos. Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. Yes, it tells the story of a truly singular talent and unpacks the music and the myth of the man behind the horn. Call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 and ask for your Jazz and Justice gift. The 80-minute talk by Dr. Horn, the film Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, the film Chasing Train on John Coltrane. It's your gift with a pledge of $100. Support Equal Rights and Justice and Truth and Justice Radio. Thanks for listening. Call 212-209-2950. I'm Mimi Rosenberg for Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.
The one is fighting for.